Buddhist Youth Association. Good afternoon, everyone. You are listening to the sound of universal compassion. Today is 9th of April. Today we will continue listen to Tenzin's previous program with the book Way of Life by Shanti Davies. Please enjoy.
This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3 or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association. Respectful, beneficial, empowering. Hello, and thank you for joining the program today. I hope that it will contribute a little to making your life meaningful, because it's very easy to sit back and relax while we have good circumstances and waste time on meaningless activities. We tend to lose sight of how very fragile and transient this life is. The Buddha's teachings tell us over and over that we should not waste a single opportunity now we are in such good circumstances, because it's not at all easy to find this situation. You may remember that the Buddha said being born a human is more rare than a turtle living at the bottom of the ocean, putting its head through a yolk bobbing up and down on the ocean surface when it comes up for air once every 100 years. Now this might seem a bit of a flight of fancy until you consider that stretching for 6,000 kilometers along the European coast from northern Italy through the south of France and into the Atlantic coast of Spain is an ant supercolony containing billions and billions of ants. But that's not all. Another such colony has taken over 900 kilometers of Californian coast, and a third colony covers 2.7 square kilometers in Japan. When you consider how many ants there are in just those three colonies, it becomes obvious how much we as humans are outnumbered. Even not taking into account all the other creatures on the earth and in the sea, we can see that if it came down to probabilities, we have a vastly greater chance of being born an ant than a human. Factoring in all the mosquitoes, flies, sea creatures, mammals, birds, reptiles, insects, and so on, and the Buddha's analogy starts making some sense. We humans might think we rule the planet, but in terms of numbers, we are heavily outgunned, and if we continue to spoil the earth out of arrogance and pure self-interest, we will inevitably be leaving the planet to cockroaches and other resilient species while we disappear into oblivion. That's one reason why the Buddha told us to act ethically and with great respect for all other creatures. What we do does impact on our environment and affect everything in it. So we have the ability to cause a lot of suffering and misery for our fellow creatures. But even worse for ourselves, the more actions motivated by self-cherishing we indulge in, the less chance we have of making progress on the spiritual path to eventual freedom from suffering, and the worse our future suffering will be. No doubt many people think that even if they abuse the planet and the other creatures living on it now, they won't have to experience the results, for they will be dead when the worst comes to the worst. But that, of course, just ignores rebirth and the reality that we are born back into our own karmic mess, probably with a mind and body much worse than our present one. So if we want another rebirth with conditions at least as good as our present one, we have to take care of our actions and keep them well within the law of cause and effect. That, of course, means being constantly mindful of what we're doing, saying and thinking, and not letting our physical, verbal, and mental actions take us into territories we will later regret. This is the theme of the chapter of the text we've been following over the last few weeks, the text called A Guide to a Bodhisattva's Way of Life by the Indian master Shantideva. We're into the fourth chapter on conscientiousness or mindfulness, and up to the verses where Shantideva is putting the fear of hell into himself. Now, I don't know that this works too well with Westerners, but certainly the Tibetans like reminding themselves again and again that our present life is like a precipice we walk along, and any misstep will send us tumbling into the abyss on either side. Shantideva tells us that it's very easy to lose our balance. Only a small miscalculation will do it, and to take a dive into the nether realms, and once there, it's extremely difficult to pull ourselves out. We'll be in such dire straits that all we can think of is our own agony and to hell with everyone else. And that is the kind of attitude that just creates more and more negative karma and hence endless more suffering. Shantideva writes, "If even by the evil of one instant an eon may be spent in the deepest hell, then because of the evil I have gathered since beginningless time, what need to mention my not going to a happy realm? By having experienced merely that rebirth in hell, I shall not still be liberated, for while it is being experienced, other evil will be extensively produced." And that is where we got up to in the last program. And now, before we continue with the fire and brimstone, let's at least make this time together the cause to go in the opposite direction from what we Westerners know as Satan and his clan. Let's, as usual, set a very positive motivation for being here together today. The best motivation being, of course, to attain enlightenment to benefit all living beings everywhere. The bodhicitta motivation. If you can, make that your motivation for listening to the program today. But if you can't, at least direct the result of the program to your own enlightenment. Thank you. Now, Shantideva goes on to say that if, having obtained this very useful human existence, we do not use it to the best of our abilities and create as much positive potential as possible, we're truly fooling ourselves and creating a nonsense out of something that could be extremely meaningful. So if, when having found leisure such as this, he says, I do not attune myself to what is wholesome, there could be no greater deception and there could be no greater folly. In her commentary to this verse, Pema Chodron says that when we act carelessly towards others, we are actually letting ourselves down. As an example, she uses the Booker T. Washington quote, "Don't let any person bring you so low as to hate them," and asks, who suffers most when we allow ourselves to become filled with hate? We betray ourselves more than others, she says. For one thing, hatred gnaws away at our own mind more than anything else. When you hate someone, you only have to hear his or her name for your mind to become upset. Our enemy doesn't even have to be on the same planet as us to harm us. Say your enemy is an astronaut who's working on a space station. He or she only has to send a message with their name down to you on Earth for you to feel uncomfortable. Enemies don't have to do anything else. They don't have to make war on you or burn your house down or steal your best begonias. They only have to send you their name on an otherwise blank sheet of paper to cloud your day. But in such a situation, we've put ourselves in the situation where the enemy has such power. Just by deciding to hate, we give ourselves over to the enemy's control. If our mind has no hatred in it, the enemy would not be able to upset us. So, as Pema Chodron says, we betray ourselves. It's not the enemy's fault, it is our own fault. This is just one example of how we cause ourselves ongoing difficulty. We could also talk about getting caught up in attachments, or pride, and so on, and how those, like the enemy, have the potential to turn our weapons against ourselves. Nevertheless, we seem very unwilling to really make an effort to change the mental habits and attitudes that invite pain. We don't want to move out of our comfort zone, even though it is often not at all comfortable. We fear what is outside the comfort zone more than we abhor the discomfort, and so do little to change. Shantideva addresses this in his next couple of verses. He says, "And if, having understood this, I still foolishly continue to be slothful, when the hour of death arrives, tremendous grief will rear its head. Then if my body blazes for a long time in the unbearable flames of hell, inevitably my mind will be tormented by the fires of unendurable remorse. Not doing anything to weaken our negative habits, but rather playing them out again and again, they enslave us, Pema Chodron points out. We have to be attentive to the law of cause and effect and realize that these habits will result in so much regret and unhappiness at death time. That, in turn, will lead to a hellish experience in which our body will feel like it's on fire while our mind will burn with remorse. Now, I'm sure you'll be able to think back on your life to actions you wish you had never even contemplated. I certainly have a few in which I harmed other creatures. Every time I think of those, my mind is filled with regret, and I feel awful remembering the pain that I caused. Sometimes it's almost as though I myself am now going through the pain that the other being experienced. In one of my classes recently, we were talking about death and what comes afterwards, and one of the people in the class told us about a book she had read about near-death experiences. One of the things that struck her was that some of the people who had such experiences talked about going through a life review, during which they themselves actually experienced the pain that they had caused others. Now, I can sympathize with this, because intense regret for our actions does have the power to make us feel some of the misery we've caused. So here, Shantideva confirms that if we don't do anything to transform or weaken our negative conditioning, it will lead us to a pain much greater than the misery our actions created. This too is borne out with experience, because some of the mean actions I hurt others with at school, for instance, still make me cringe some 50 years later, while the people who suffered them may not even remember or may well have moved on. The impetus for regret and misery live on in my mind, even though the situation has long since dissolved with the passing of time. It's said that after death, our mind is in a much more sensitive state than during life, so it seems natural that our present regret will cause even more discomfort then. That, in turn, will inform our coming life, and there we have the very basis for a hellish experience. So now Shantideva goes on, having found by some coincidence this beneficial state that is so hard to find, if now, while able to discriminate, I once again am led into the hells, then, as though I were hypnotized by a spell, I shall reduce this mind to nothing. Even I do not know what is causing me confusion. What is there dwelling inside me? In his commentary up to this verse, His Holiness the Dalai Lama says that perhaps it will be easier for people who do not subscribe to Buddhism, and they will not have much regret. But Buddhists who are aware of the law of cause and effect, coming to death and realizing that they have not created much positive potential, that they've basically wasted their lives, could experience great regret and find themselves in very difficult straits at death time. They know that they're heading for a torturous experience, and so their minds will have so much remorse for what they threw away. But then it's too late. Now, while we have the chance, says Pema Chodron, we must make the choice how to relate to our emotions. Every moment we have the opportunity to decide to react differently, not to follow our habitual urges, and while we can, we shouldn't ignore this opportunity. If we know that habitual patterns inevitably bring us pain, we can do something about it. But she also realizes that those patterns are very strong, and it's very difficult to make intelligent choices about them, even if we know they bring pain. It's not that we want the pain, but we just do what is familiar. And so it is as if we were hypnotized, reduced to impotence, and overwhelmed by confusion. What, asks Shantideva, has got us so in its grip? And Pema Chodron answers, it is the kleshas, the afflictive emotions, aggression, craving, ignorance, jealousy, arrogance, pride, and so on. And what power, asks Shantideva, do these great tormentors have? Just look at them. Although enemies such as hatred and craving have neither any arms or legs, and are neither courageous nor wise, How have I been used like a slave by them? They're craven, he says. They're without limbs, courage and wisdom. And yet we give in to them as if we are their slaves. True, they are what Pema Chodron calls ungraspable energies, but they have so much power over us and cause us so much harm. Shantideva goes on now to list five faults of these kleshas, five ways in which they make us their obedient slaves. The first is the very enslavement described in the verse we've just read. Although enemies such as hatred and craving have neither any arms nor legs and are neither courageous nor wise, how have I been used like a slave by them? Watch what happens as we react emotionally, says Pema Chodron. We first experience a slight tightening. It's only slight, but it very quickly leads to chaos if we do not pay attention. As she says, in just a few seconds, we go from being slightly miffed to completely out of control. Still, we can catch it in the early stages. We have the inherent wisdom and ability. To the degree that we are attentive, says Pema Chodron, we can nip the addictive urge while it's still manageable. Just as we are about to step into the trap, we can at least pause and take some deep breaths before proceeding. Just being aware of what is happening undercuts the power of the affliction. In my own experience, I can easily recognize what she's talking about here. Thinking back on the times that I've been challenged by other people, I can remember the initial tightening Pema Chodron talks about, a kind of closing down to what the other person is saying. There's a feeling of being threatened, even if only lightly, as though one's point of view, which one is so convinced about, is being assaulted. If we can see what the mind is doing at that stage, catch it in that defensive mode and relax, it's very helpful for the defense not to become offense and blow up into something that does not warrant all the energy we are putting into it. Shantideva then goes on pointing out the second fault of the afflictive emotions, their familiarity. For while they dwell within my mind, at their pleasure they cause me harm, yet I patiently endure them without any anger, but this is an inappropriate and shameful time for patience. We love the drama that they bring. Pema Chodron says they give us something to hold on to. These afflictive emotions set off a chain reaction that we find irresistible. Hatred, for instance, she writes, can make us feel strong and in charge. Rage makes us feel even more powerful and invulnerable. Craving and wanting can feel soothing, romantic, and nostalgic. We weep over lost loves or unfulfilled dreams. It's painfully and deliciously bittersweet. Therefore, we don't even consider interrupting the flow. Ignorance is oddly comforting. We don't have to do anything. We just lie back and don't relate to what is happening around us. Now, we each cling to and nurture our particular mix of afflictions, identifying them with our concept of me and who I am. Thus, they become important to us and our self-view. And until we actually stop and be attentive to what they're doing, we let them do with us what they will. We have to realize that for all their seductiveness, they always lead us into trouble. But we won't realize that until we start being mindful. Pema Chodron warns that we cannot be naive. While we are beguiled by these afflictive emotions, we will never make an effort to stop their harm. We will always give in to them. Even knowing how destructive they are, we tend to think, I'll give in only this once. Surely only one time can't cause too much damage. But giving in to the seduction just leads to stronger seduction, and it becomes increasingly more difficult to escape. As Pema Chodron says, we will never be motivated to interrupt the seductiveness. We will always be too complacent and accommodating. A good analogy for the kleshas is a drug pusher, she says. When we want drugs, the pusher is our friend. We welcome him because our addiction is so strong. But when we want to get clean, we associate the pusher with misery, and he becomes someone to avoid. Shantideva's advice is to treat our crippling emotions like drug pushers. If we don't want to stay addicted for life, we have to see that our negative emotions weaken us and cause us harm. But freeing ourselves from our negative emotions is just as difficult as to detox from drugs or alcohol, Pema Chodron maintains. But if we can realize how they ruin our lives, we can become highly motivated to defeat them. But I tell you this about klesha addiction, she writes. Without the intelligence to see that it harms us and the clear intention to turn it around, that familiar urge will be very hard to interrupt before it's going strong. Do not, however, underestimate the healing power of self-reflection. For example, when you're about to say a mean word or indulge in self-righteousness or criticism, just reflect on the spot. If I strengthen this habit, will it bring suffering or relief? She points out, however, that we must be honest with ourselves. It's not enough to just accept what the text or the monk says, or Buddha, or Shantideva. We have to go by our own experience. Lots of Westerners don't think of their lives in terms of its dissatisfactions. Of course, they do have problems and difficulties, but balance them against the good times. They don't think their emotions are the cause of their problems, and so whether our emotions bring us satisfaction or not is something we have to work out for ourselves. However, His Holiness emphasizes that as long as we live under the sway of the afflictions, and as long as we make no attempt to get rid of them, we will never be free of the turbulence that they bring to our lives. And we will always go from one unstable and often tumultuous life to another. And Shantideva points out that nothing has the same power as the afflictive emotions to cause trouble. Should even all the gods and anti-gods rise up against me as my enemies, they could not lead nor place me in the roaring fires of deepest hell. But the mighty foe, these disturbing conceptions, in a moment can cast me amidst those flames, which when met will cause not even the ashes of the king of mountains to remain. All other enemies are incapable of remaining for such a length of time as can my disturbing conceptions, the long-time enemy with neither beginning nor end. He says that even the most powerful beings in samsaric existence, the gods and the asuras, cannot throw us into the states of torment that the afflictive emotions can. When we give the afflictive emotions free rein, we can find ourselves in such terrible situations as would destroy the greatest of mountains. Even discounting hellish states in coming existences, in this life we go through hideous experiences when giving in to the disturbing conceptions. Take, for instance, the phenomenon we call falling in love. This is often based on a physical attraction that appears to be absolutely compelling. The person we're in love with appears to be almost without fault, and the more infatuated we become, the more perfect they appear to be. However, our emotion has very little to do with the person we dote on, but everything to do with the conception that attachment paints in our mind. And then we get together with this person, and maybe under the driving influence of attachment, marry him or her. But given a little time, when we are forced to face the reality of the person now so interwoven with our life, a reality that fits increasingly more uneasily with the picture in our heart, we become disillusioned. And where the compulsion of desire and attachment once reigned, dissatisfaction, disgust, and even hatred take over. And once that relationship is finally and often very messily over, what do? We allow the attachment to persuade us that the failed relationship was just an aberration and we should start the whole process all over again with someone else. And again, and again, and again, to infinity. So, Shantideva says, no other enemy has the capacity to torment us for the interminable length of time the afflictions have. As long as we give in to our conditioning and the afflictive emotions, we will be doomed to repeat the same painful mistakes over and over and over. As His Holiness points out, our physical enemies are generally not long-lasting. We can turn them around and make them our friends, or perhaps we or they can move to another country, and so we lose touch. But wherever we go, the afflictive emotions go with us, ever ready to delude us into thinking that situations of suffering are actually enjoyable or can be made so, or just to cast us into circumstances of massive sorrow. So there is the third fault of these afflictions. If we are not mindful, they will harm us for a very long time. Those we despised or once craved for will be well out of our lives, while the habitual tendencies of hatred and attachment are still lurking around, causing havoc. The more we give into our habitual patterns, the stronger they become. The stronger they become, the more we give into them. Thus our imprisonment, Pema Chodron says, becomes more and more intense until we feel hopelessly trapped with a monstrous companion. Can any outer enemy torture us like this? If I agreeably honor and entrust myself to others, they will bring me benefit and happiness. But if I entrust myself to these disturbing conceptions, in future they will bring only misery and harm. Again, His Holiness says that if we are kind to our physical enemies, they may well, in due course, realize our positive intentions and become our friends. But be kind and tolerant with the afflictive emotions, and we will only give ourselves over to ongoing harm. So the fourth fault of the afflictions is that given an inch, they will take a mile. Many miles, in fact. Pema Chodron continues with the analogy of the drug pusher, who has strategies and seductions to lure us back into his grip. We simply cannot afford to be ignorant about the power of emotions, she says. We can neither welcome nor indulge them in hopes they'll bring us happiness or security. The teachings tell us to make friends with our emotions, but that doesn't mean we give in or become companionable with them. It means we have to understand them by being attentive and working with them firmly but compassionately. This is how the great master Thich Nhat Hanh described it in his book Peace in Every Step. The first step in dealing with feelings is to recognize each feeling as it arises. The agent that does this is mindfulness. In the case of fear, for example, you bring out your mindfulness. Look at your fear and recognize your fear. You know fear springs from yourself, and that mindfulness also springs from yourself. They are both in you, not fighting, but one taking care of the other. The second step is to become one with the feeling. It is best not to say, "Go away, fear, I don't like you, you're not me." It's much more effective to say, "Hello, fear, how are you today?" Then you can invite the two aspects of yourself, mindfulness and fear, to shake hands as friends and become one. Doing this may seem frightening, but because you know that you are more than just your fear, you need not be afraid. As long as mindfulness is there, it can chaperone your fear. The fundamental practice is to nourish your mindfulness with conscious breathing, to keep it there, alive and strong. Although your mindfulness may not be very powerful in the beginning, if you nourish it, it will become stronger. As long as mindfulness is present, you will not drown in your fear. In fact, you begin transforming it the very moment you give birth to awareness in yourself. And with that sage and most beautiful advice, we must now part. Thank you for joining the program today, and please do so again next week. Please dedicate any positive energy from the program to gaining enlightenment for the sake of all beings. Thank you, and goodbye. This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3, or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association. Respectful. Beneficial. Empowering.